Accession number 9422, Reel 2.
Mr. Harold Hayward, Reel 2. You were telling me about the songs you used to sing on the route marches.
Yes.
Could you continue?
Yes. Well, one song was written by a well-known solicitor in Bristol who used to have big services at the Corsand Hall on Sundays, which used to be crowded. You could probably get a couple of thousand people there. He wrote a song, Bravo Bristol, and Ivor Novello put it to music.
Can you remember any of it now?
No. It's just gone from me. It'll come at another time.
And you'd sing regularly throughout the route march, would you?
Off and on. Sometimes we made up a few verses anent a particular officer that we sang. If it was one way of letting him know what he was thought of, and put it to a popular tune.
Would the officers object?
Well, they had to march on with this somewhat critical words to a well-known tune, like say to Tipperary or to something like that.
Would you get regular rests while you were marching on the route march?
Oh yes, throughout the war, the regular instruction about route marching was you marched for 50 minutes and rested for 10 every hour.
What would happen on a rest?
Well, we could take our packs off and sit on the ground if it was dry, and put our feet up. That's one thing I learned. It was a good thing to put your feet above your head, and so it wasn't if you had 10 miles or 20 or 50 miles to do, you had, in every 1 hour, 10 minutes were resting, 50 minutes were marching.
What would the local population do if they saw you out on a route march? Would they?
Oh yes, they'd all, because we would have our band. I think the city paid for the instruments. We'd have our band marching in front, and people would at once congregate on the pavement, as we marched through the city. It was their battalion, and we were their favourites, if you put it that way.
To look at other parts of your training, did you do any actual rifle shooting, or was it just rifle drill?
Yes, I'm just trying to think. Did we have any? We certainly did not fire our musketry course, not for a 12 month. But I think we had small arms. I'd had at school. Just to get ourselves used to sighting. On the target, on the bullseye target, and how to hold and press the rifle, when you pressed you pull it aside. It had to be a squeeze as you looked along the sights. But I know we were the first Kitchener battalion to have the new sight as distinct from what they'd had, what had been in use during the Boer War. It was a great advantage because you could raise the actual sighting up above and adjust it to the distance which your target was away. In fact, we had to learn to judge distances too because of that.
How would you go about that?
Well, just through practice, you know. How far away is that? Is it 150? Is it 200? Or is it 80? Because on that you would adjust the sights on your rifle to fire at a target at that distance.
Did you do any bayonet drill at all, or bayonet fighting practice?
Yes, well, because now the bayonet on the Lee Metford was a short bayonet, but the bayonet on the smaller Lee Enfield was a longer bayonet. But overall, they're about the same length from point of bayonet to butt. And we did do some, and one of our instructors, an old-time regular sergeant, he actually had used a bayonet at Omdurman, which was, but we didn't. There was not much bayonet used in the Boer War, I don't think. It was all shooting at a distance because the Boers were, that was where they had the advantage because they were such good shots.
What was your bayonet drill and practice then? What would you do?
Well, first of all, you had to learn how to draw it from the scabbard. That was there was a laid down method of that before you got it plunk on the front of the on the top of the rifle. I know three of the phrases: in, out, on guard. That was bayonet drill. And
did you have any dummy targets?
Yes, we had. I think large sacks full of some. I forget what it was. May have been just a cloth or something like that, you know. But just to learn how to bayonet a person. Incidentally, I never saw or ever heard of a person being bayoneted in France. Never. And we were with a regular division when we went out.
Did you have any... Bombs were at a fairly early stage then, but did you have any bombing practice, hand bombing, while you were at the exhibition?
Yes, I'm just trying to... No, not when I was up, we were at the White Lady Road Exhibition Artillery Grounds, but I'm just trying to think whether we threw bombs when we were at Ashton Gate. I'm just trying to think of the bombing, whether we had a bombing range there. I don't think if we did, they weren't live bombs. They hadn't explosive, but just to learn the action of that action.
Overarm action.
Yes, overarm. But it was later that where they were actual live Mills bombs.
Did you have any practice in digging trenches or the modern or trench warfare? Did you have any sort of practice in that?
No, hardly any. We might have had practice in digging trenches as you would take up a position, but the idea of them being your home, no one had thought of that. Even in France, that it hadn't come to that stage of the trench being your 24-hour accommodation.
What were your tactical exercises like? You know, did you do any tactical exercises?
Yes, we did. Generally, one company against another company, and then you'd have the adjutant and the colonel. You know, you're a casualty. You're a casualty. This half platoon is it got its flank exposed and can be considered out. So in order to get us used to what we're that it was thought we should be meeting with in actual warfare.
But it was open warfare, you mean?
Oh, yes, entirely, yes. No trench warfare at all.
Were you given any special training in anything like signalling or anything like that?
No, I wasn't, but some people went into the signal section, others went into the machine gun section. There were no machine guns for the first 6 months, but we did have one after 6 months, and everybody would have liked to have got into it, so the particular officer who was going to be the machine gun officer, he could pick and choose his men.
You didn't have any special training yourself, then?
I myself didn't have any machine gun training until I was a cadet. Long time.
So you stayed an ordinary rifleman?
I stayed, yes, as a rifleman, yes.
I'd like now to look at the sort of conditions you were living at while you were up at Ashton Gate. You say the uniform arrived. Could you tell me about that?
Yes, of course, it was a great day when we put on khaki, which was because other similar battalions raised by cities couldn't get hold of any. They had to wait till the factories started just to make khaki. Well, we were in khaki, and yes, we felt we were soldiers then when we were wearing puttees and khaki trousers and jacket and their peaked hat.
You were very proud of your uniform then?
Exceedingly so, yes. We looked after it. I think we had two sets, one for special purposes and one for when we were out practicing field fighting, you know, because we were lying down on the ground. And we also had another outfit just for, as you say, walking out or marching through Bristol.
Was that the same? Were they all khaki?
All khaki, yes.
Who provided it? Was it the army or was it the Bristol merchants?
Well, it would have to have, I don't know how it happened. Of course, in the normal way, it's the army authorities. They issue the equipment and uniform, but we certainly got ours long before other similar battalions got theirs. I think perhaps because we had as our colonel, our commanding officer, a colonel who'd been in the Gloucestershire regiment before, the Gloucesters, and they must have got in very early with their order.
What was your accommodation like at Ashton Gate?
Well, it, as I say, there were four large halls, each containing a company comfortably. Couldn't be better. We had our beds. That's to say, three planks on two little stands. And I found them not at all. And then, of course, they had a mattress filled with straw. That I think was delivered to us complete. But later on, when we got down to Codford, we had to fill the mattress, canvas mattresses with straw, and the idea was, of course, to just fill it in. Otherwise, in a month's time, you were just lying on bare board. But use as much straw as you could push in to give you a comfortable bed after much lying on.
Was the room crowded at all, or was there?
No, you will have seen it in there, and we slept alongside our friends, and we slept in with a section together, and four of those in a platoon together, and We had two platoons down one side of the hall, two platoons down the other side of the hall. Quite convenient, both for sleeping and for dressing and undressing. We slept in our underclothes, but one or two people brought their pyjamas, which were rather derided. And the other things which I feel I should say, that one or two fellows knelt down and said their prayers in the front of everybody, and nobody threw a brick at them. I mean, no matter what they themselves might have, their attitude to religion would be, at least they respected that. And I admire those chaps who did that, who actually knelt down by the bed. Others doubtless said their prayers as they were lying down.
What was life like in one of these barrack huts?
Well, we were only there really for sleeping. We didn't feed there. The cookhouse which would take a company at a time. You know, we probably half an hour, say between 12:30 and perhaps 2:00. The 2:00 people might have been there route march or doing field operations and only back in. Those who were doing musketry or practice or handling of arms, of rifles, might be having theirs at 12:30. And they'd go out, and then there was you took your turn in being a mess orderly, in which you peeled potatoes and then washed up afterwards.
What was the food like? What would you get for each of the meals?
Well, plenty of meat, plenty of meat, potatoes and another vegetable. On occasion, I think a second course, like rice. But ample food. That was for midday meal.
And what about breakfast?
Yes, we'd have bread and bacon, fried bacon, and butter. But no marmalade, no, just bread and butter and fried bacon, sometimes, and sausages, which would anything like that. I don't think we went as far as having kidneys, but certainly it was quite an adequate breakfast for the physical strain that the body was going to have, which in many cases it hadn't before. But you know, folk who played rugby, football, or things like that, they'd already been used to a bit of strenuous life at times.
What about the evening meals?
Well, we had a breakfast. We were called to a parade and marched off, you know, by bugle. Called to a parade, marched off in order to these dining halls. And then midday too, but tea time, I think by tea time we were some of us who weren't on duty could finish the day at, say, 4:30 and go and spend the evening with out in the town or to our homes, which I did. I know I was always pleased to have my mother, of course, thought I was being starved, and she always had a good meal for me, but it wasn't entirely necessary because I'd had two good meals already. And then we'd get back by midnight. 10:00 in the normal way, but if you had a late pass, you could be out till 12. If you came in after 12, well, those who were on sentry duty took you into charge, and you were went on a crime sheet, as they say, for being late into barracks.
What would you, if there was an evening meal, what would you eat?
Just bread and butter and jam, the famous plum and apple jam, the army jam.
Would you get anything for supper or anything like that?
No, unless you were on sentry duty, and then you might get something at about 10:30, because you were being exposed, you know, on your tours of 2 hours on during the daytime and 4 off, and at night time 1 hour on sentry duty, on sentry box at significant points to stop people from breaking in, and of course to stop people from breaking out.
And was there any canteen sort of facilities, yes, where you could buy your own?
Yes, there was. Yes, there was a very good canteen where sandwiches you could get, and I don't think it was much, but you could get sandwiches, ham sandwiches, and then there were all drinks available. We had to pay for
all this army life. How did you react to the lack of privacy and the discipline of army life?
Well, I'd been at a boarding school, so it wasn't quite so strange to me. But I don't know how it would have affected boys, young men who hadn't been away from home at all, either on holidays by themselves, or that, of course, some had been scouts and so they'd been away like that. That was half an introduction. But of course, through 5 years at school, at the boarding school, I was quite used to what was not very, that the army life was not very dissimilar from life at the school, as regards sleeping. That's that part of it.
What about the inspections and kit inspections?
Yes,
like?
we used to have those once a month, and you had to have everything. I used to be able to run through the different articles and see that I'd got one of each. So when the inspecting officer came round, company officer, either possibly the second in command of the company would come round to see for the kit inspection of both garments and the ordinary utensils issued by the army for everyday use.
Was this a very strict inspection?
Yes, it was. It was, yes. It seemed to be quite a crime not to have got some article like a toothbrush, shall we say. I suppose that in the old pre-war days they could disappear. Possibly, I don't know whether the old regulars raised a penny or two in selling them. But what we had, I hadn't started to shave, and the razors issued were open razors, cutthroat razors. I started to learn to shave with a cutthroat razor. Nicked myself once or twice, but you got into the habit of it by using both, either hand.
How did you get on with your fellow privates, you know, the people of the same rank as yourself?
Yes, very well, because two at least lived in the same suburb as me, and I knew them, one of which was at school with me, and the other one was in a choir with me. So generally speaking, looking round my own section of about 14 men in charge of a corporal, we were very happy to go on no difficulty at all.
What was the origin of that? Were they of similar backgrounds to yourself?
Because of that, that's why we got on well. What one liked had been brought up to accept, so the others had done so.
There was no bullying or no factions?
Not at all. I didn't see any bullying whatsoever.
How did you get on with the next level up, the NCOs?
Oh, reasonably well, because we'd all been privates to commence with together, and they'd risen, you know, being a lance corporal, to be a corporal, to be a platoon sergeant. But even though they had attained this rank, it didn't stop us from being. But we'd known them when we were all of one rank.
So there wasn't a great divide between you.
Not at all, no, not at all, no.
What about the instructors, the sergeants who acted as instructors? What were they like?
As I say, some of them were commissionaires to a block of buildings where the director became a private. But it fitted in very well, and once we were in Corku, I think a more, they felt themselves back in their old army, first decade of this century situation.
What was their attitude like to you, the ordinary?
Yes, who hadn't? Yes, well, they required strict and immediate obedience, and I suppose we were all rookies together, recruits together, so they couldn't pick out one person different from the other. In fact, I learned a square drill, a barrack square drill at school, so I didn't have to be crimed for turning the wrong way.
So basically, you got on well with the NCOs. There was no.
No. Of course, they got a little more distant from us. That when they became a sergeant, they didn't feed with us. They had their own sergeant's mess, so that separated them a little bit. But it really didn't give them any great superiority.
How about the? The senior NCOs, the regimental sergeant majors, the company sergeant majors.
Yes, well, the company sergeant major, he was regarded, and we said sir to him, I think, to the company sergeant major, and the regimental sergeant major, he wore a sword, and of course he was regarded as almost as higher with higher respect as the colonel was.
What about the officers themselves? How did you get on with them? What was the relationship
yes,
like?
Yes, of course, they were commissioned, and we were non. We hadn't a commission, but they were senior men who nearly all had had some previous military, if not war, experience. So they knew more than we knew, and then when they went away to different schools of instruction and brought their absence of all. Or out-of-date knowledge of the army up to date, 1914.
Were they all ex-veterans, or were the second lieutenants newly enlisted?
Yes, a lot were newly enlisted. Many from their own ranks, just the same as the a fellow might rise through lance corporal up to, I believe one did to company sergeant major, but really that rank was. There were so many pre-war sergeants, you know, who, if when one became a casualty or didn't come out with us, would take that place.
But the young second lieutenants, they
yes.
were respected, were they, the new ones?
Well, we judged them on what they were. Some we had, we soon formed an opinion of what sort of person they were, and. If they're any different from that, they probably heard of it in the song when we were marching behind them.
What sort of faults might you identify in one of these songs? What sort of things would irritate you about an officer?
Well, if he was pernickety, we might think of someone, some were more pernickety than the other. All that it was that he was just his interpretation of what is the regular army standard.
What qualities, on the other hand,
yes.
would you look for? What would make you think someone was a good officer?
That he always knew something more than you knew about any particular thing. You couldn't tell him anything, really, that he didn't know. That was the, and he would do everything that you were called upon to do. That was regarded as essential.
And most of the officers matched up to that, did they?
Yes, of course. It's surprising, as